If you're betting March Madness, you should be doing it at MyBookie. This is the best betting stretch of the year. Upsets, buzzer beaters, and if you're going to take your shot, you might as well take it where the payouts hit harder. Only at MyBookie, you've got the money bag. Money bag gives you boosted odds and juiced payouts on select games. Same picks, bigger potential returns. When you're staring at that Sweet 16 matchup or loading up a Final Four play, MyBookie can turn a good hit into a great one. This isn't the week to sit back and wait. Lines are moving, futures are tightening. The edge is right now. Head to mybookie.ag, use code NBASZN, and get your first bet covered up to $500. If it misses, just activate your bet back bonus token and run it back. March only comes once. Bet it smart, bet it big. Only at MyBookie.
Dr. Sid Young is the founder of Out Wellness ATX, Austin's most inclusive queer and trans-focused wellness center. A physical therapist and strength coach, Sid specializes in gender-affirming care and creates safe spaces for healing, movement, and community. They're a passionate advocate for trans rights, offering free weekly workouts and speaking out nationally against anti-trans legislation. Thank you so much for joining from Texas today. Much warmer than it is in London, I can assure you. There's loads I want to ask you, but I just wanted to start by taking you back a little bit, if that was okay, just to understand what your teenager formative years were like. Is there a very clear link between the person you were then, who you are today?
Yeah, I mean, you know, like we were chatting about a second ago, I grew up in Austin. So I was here all of my formative years. Mm-hmm. And I played tennis. That was really like who I was. That was my entire personality, as a tennis player. I spent 2 years at a public school in high school, and then I transferred to like a very specific tennis high school for my last 2 years of high school. Where we played like 8 hours of tennis a day, and, you know, kind of did school on the side. And so that was a huge part of my identity, which, you know, looking back is pretty hard as a bigger bodied queer person. Like, that's not generally who you see in the tennis world. And so I had a lot of feelings about my body. People had a lot to say about my body, especially like, as I was getting recruited to go to college, and then I played in college as well. And so the way uniforms fit me, I didn't look like everybody else. I kind of didn't fit in with any of the people I played tennis with through college. And so I always just felt othered. Like, I always just was like, I am weird, or like, I don't fit in. And I came into my queerness my freshman year of college, just because I met queer people. And I was like, oh, that makes sense to me. And so I started to find my group of people a little bit more. But I think the formative years, especially of like playing tennis and just like not understanding why I didn't belong, really helped drive what I'm trying to create with Out Wellness, which is like, nobody ever feels that way. Like, we're all weird in our own weird way. And like, that's really cool and special. And I think a lot of it has to do with how I felt through college and even into grad school. I'm a physical therapist, so I did 3 years of grad school after my bachelor's. And even there, like, being a person in a bigger body in physical therapy school is not great. And they have a lot to say about quote unquote research and like all of these things. And so I just, like, I wanted to create a space where it doesn't matter what you look like, it doesn't matter your body size, it doesn't matter what your gender or sexual orientation is, like, this is just a space for you. And I think a lot of my experiences in tennis and in grad school kind of like informed that.
It's very interesting. I mean, actually, there's been the recent social media furore about Serena Williams promoting a fat loss drug.
Yeah.
And throughout her career, you know, she's incredibly successful, dominant, along with her sister, incredible tennis player that won so many Grand Slams, you can't imagine it. But throughout her career, she was challenged so much for not looking like Maria Sharapova. And do you think, she's got a big butt and she's got strong legs and she's got strong arms and shoulders. And it was almost that, okay, you're winning, but we don't really like the way you look though. So can you almost, it's a horrible thing to say, can you almost sort of beautify how you look and still keep winning? And I know we do see more plus size models. We do see more people in the theater, on stage, in film, in music that are bigger body. But even though all of that, there does still seem to be stigma around body size. Do you agree? Or I mean, do you think we move forward, or are we just kidding ourselves a little bit?
You know, it's really interesting. My body size has fluctuated pretty significantly over the course of my life. I would say I'm like medium sized right now. I've been like 150 pounds heavier. I've been like 50 pounds lighter. And, you know, so I'm like, you know, all over the spectrum, really.
Yeah.
And when I was at my absolute heaviest, my coach was like, should you consider weight loss surgery? Like, should you consider some of these things? I'm making it seem like a suggestion now. It wasn't so much of a suggestion when I was 19 and, you know, hearing this from the person who I was taking orders from, essentially. And it turns out that, one, I was way healthier at that heavier weight than I actually am now, and I'm much lighter. But two, nobody mentioned this, but I was one of the winningest athletes of all time at the school that I went to. But that was completely overlooked because of my body size. And like all anybody probably remembers, I would assume, I don't really talk to anybody from my college tennis team, but it was like, I always had to wear a different uniform, or like I had to wear like oversized t-shirts. And like, I'm sure that like was the highlight of everybody's experience, when in reality, all I really did was win. I mean, I know that's an exaggeration, but like, no. You know, and so yeah. Even in that minute example, and certainly in terms of like the Serena Williams caliber, not even close, but it's all anybody really talked about to me or about me. And Serena was exactly the same. Although there, I do think there's a ton of racism in tennis too, which definitely played in, because her and Venus were two of the first Black athletes there in the tennis scene. But I mean, Serena Williams is, in my opinion, the greatest athlete of all time. Like, she has done incredible things, like feats of human nature.
Yeah.
And all people can talk about is her body size. And now all people can talk about is that she's promoting this weight loss drug. So it's like, no matter what she's doing, they're
I know what you do,
right? And so it's just this crazy thing. Like, instead of being like, oh my God, like I was just at the US Open and I just watched Venus play. And I was like, Venus is 45 and incredible. And how am I lucky enough to still get to watch her play tennis? But she didn't get a lot of the stuff that Serena got just because of her body size. And to your point, she was compared to Maria Sharapova often. When they're two completely different players. And honestly, two completely different calibers of player. Like, if you're looking at their history, like throughout their time playing tennis, like, I mean, Serena was winning Grand Slams pregnant. Like, Serena was like doing the thing, you know? And so in my opinion, nobody can compare to her. But yeah, I think we see a lot of now, like my BMI is over 30 even now. And every time I go to the doctor for a checkup, they automatically refer me to their weight loss clinic, which is Ozempic. I can't opt out. I can't tell them I don't want it. Like, I mean, I can once they call me, but I can't opt out on the front end. Like, they call me, they ask me if I want to do this. And I'm like, me and my doctor didn't talk about my weight at all. And so, you know, I think it's hard because we've had people who historically are like really proud to be big. Like, Lizzo is another great example of that. Mm-hmm. Really proud to be big, really vocal about that. And then they lose a lot of weight. And so, you know, it's hard. And I think a lot of folks in bigger bodies who are in bigger bodies for a lot of different reasons, one, because they want to be, or two, because of like chronic illness, chronic pain, chronic disease, you know, there's a ton of things. But like in my body, I'm like, I want to be big. I want to be strong. And want or need like a weight loss drug. I'm not trying to lose weight. And so I think it a little bit depends on the day, but I do think it's maybe a little bit, I think people maybe think we're making a little bit more progress than we are in that regard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I listened to a podcast the other day with Rebel Wilson. Uh-huh. She was the bridesmaid actress. She was she was named Fat Amy in the Picture Perfect thing. And she said the same. So she again, dropped a ton of weight. All of her, she almost made it out that she was being almost made to be remain bigger. She, oh, my management company, my PR, maybe they said, no, your niche is this sort of action or whatever. But the interviewer said, well, when were you happy? She said, oh gosh, I've always been super happy. I never thought about the weight. It was just who I am. It was just the person I am, I think more. Why have you lost all the weight then? And she didn't have a stronger answer as I thought she'd had. But just touching on BMI, isn't it extraordinary that BMI is still a measure people use? I mean, I look at bodybuilders or weightlifters or anybody really. It doesn't tell you anything about how fit and healthy a person is. Like you were saying, you were probably healthier or fitter at a different weight than you are now. But if somebody got your BMI to 20, but oh, well done, that's it, great, you've cracked it, you're perfectly healthy now. I said, well, but I'm not really. I'm really, really not. So it's, and there's a documentary on Netflix in the UK at the moment about the, used to be a program called The Biggest Loser.
Just about to tell
you. And I watched the first episode, and it sounds really weird. It upset me so much. I struggled, and I thought, I will watch the next two, but it was horrendous in terms of the people just literally for a week or two not eating anything at all, not drinking, and then people, you know, 300 pounds went down to 140, 6 months later, 320 pounds. It was there's no thoughts of longevity, to health, to anything at all. It was just around this, right, no, big is bad, small is good. And that sounds really simplistic, but that's what it felt like when I watched it.
And it's really interesting too, because, you know, a lot of people say things like, oh, you know, they did the best that they had, the best that they could with what they had. And like, even if you can say that that's true, which I don't think it is, but if you were to say that, you still had the trainers and the doctors and the producers right now on this documentary saying things like, we changed people's lives for the better. We made them healthier. And my question always to that is, by what statistic, by what measure, what are we actually measuring? Because it's the assumption, it's the societal assumption that people in bigger bodies are diabetic or have high blood sugar or have high cholesterol or whatever, high blood pressure, and they're on all these meds. And if they lose weight, they'll get off the meds. That's the societal assumption for sure. But are we actually measuring that? And are we actually like, are we actually saying like this person is objectively healthier, or are we just saying because they lost 150 pounds in 12 weeks that they're healthier because they're thinner? And I thought that documentary was really interesting. It was very upsetting. But I thought it was interesting because they had a person on there who was from a podcast. Oh, I'm forgetting the name of the podcast, but she was wonderful in the documentary. And she was talking about how the show almost gave permission for skinny people to just demoralize fat people. Like, just like the way Jillian Michaels and whatever the guy's name is, Bob Harper did, because they're fit. And so they're allowed to just do that and treat fat people this way. And I just thought it was it's called Maintenance Phase is the podcast that she's on. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was really interesting the way that she talked about it too. But, BMI is not an indicator of health. It's been shown over and over and over again in the research that is not an indicator of health. In PT school, we had to do research to be able to graduate with our doctorate. Mm-hmm. And in almost all of the studies in our class, there was exclusion criteria for BMI that was above 30. So I couldn't participate in any of the research that my classmates were doing because my BMI was over 30. And it's just like random things like that. Meanwhile, also in my class was a bodybuilder, who was deemed very healthy. He was a humongous guy. Meanwhile, he had been on, blood thinners for like 3 or 4 years because he actually, like I was actually objectively healthier than he was, but because of the way we were carrying our weight or, you know, whatever the case may be, everybody was like, oh, this person is exceptionally healthy and knows all about health and wellness. And I was in a different camp because I weighed a little bit more or carried my weight differently. And so I think it's just a really interesting thing. But I think the Biggest Loser documentary is a great example of how we treat folks in bigger bodies and we don't take into consideration, like, how big do they want to be? Like, we don't actually know. And do they want to be skinny? Like, there's a woman in the podcast who wanted to lose weight to save her marriage. And we're like, and I'm like, okay, that person should have been weeded out of this process, right? Like, if you're really trying to make people healthier, then get people who want to lose weight because they need to be objectively healthier, not because they want to save their marriage and fit back into the lingerie that they were in 10 years ago.
Yeah. Another, it just does still seem to be one of the issues where people view it very differently than, racism or sexism or whatever those things, because there's a lot of people often have this notion, well, people can do something about their size, they can fix their size. So all the research shows that people, when they go for job interviews of a certain size, they've done it so many times over with exactly the same qualifications, this person, that person, one person's 300 pounds, one person's 150, and the stats are off astronomically towards the notion that, well, bigger people get lazier, they have less self-determination, they have less ability to limit themselves or do things, whatever. And it's that view that, yeah, sort of lazy and inability to keep their head out the fridge. It's a crazy thing. But because people think, well, yeah, but you can fix it, without, as you say, necessarily saying, well, but what is it they're fixing? And what makes you believe they have something to fix or want to fix something? And it's such a terrible word to use. And So just moving on from that, otherwise we'll get caught up on that forever. But just what was it that led you to found and develop Out Wellness AXT? And what is it that makes it different from other health and fitness and well-being places?
Yeah, so I graduated PT school in 2020. The pandemic had just started. And I went straight into like a pretty typical sports PT clinic. Like, you know, you get surgery, you go to PT. It was a pretty typical place like that. And I did my residency and my fellowship there. And it was a great experience. I loved my mentor. He was wonderful. I learned a lot. But I saw time and again, marginalized people just getting worse care. And that was true of the doctors. That was true of the PTs. It was probably true of me. Like the system is just designed that way. We saw a lot of queer people, a lot of young people, and a lot of Spanish speakers. We were right outside of campus here in Austin. And so that was a lot of our population. And so after 2 years, I was really burnt out. And I was like, I need to make a change in my work life period. And so I was actually talking to my dad, who is an entrepreneur, and I was telling him all this stuff. And I was like, I really think I can do it better. And he was like, well, then do it.
That's cool, isn't it?
And I had a garage gym for myself at my house. And he was just like, do it out of your garage gym. If there's no overhead, you've already got the equipment. If it fails, you'll go out and you'll get another PT job that will probably pay you more money than what you're making now anyway. And if it works, like, that's really cool. And so I literally just started seeing people in my garage gym. That lasted 3 years. And then we're in 1900 square feet now. And we've been here for a little over a year. But like, it was really a combination of burnout in the healthcare world and just really genuinely believing that I could serve our communities better than the general healthcare system is. And so we just take a lot of pride in creating a physical safe space, but also an emotionally safe space for everybody that walks in, whether it's like somebody who wasn't believed in the healthcare system or a person in a bigger body who was offered Ozempic or a trans person who tried to go to Gold's and got sexualized, or just like a cis person who wants to come into the gym for the first time and like kind of doesn't know where to start. And so We really want to create a safe space for everybody, excluding transphobes. We don't want transphobes here, but everybody else, you obviously don't have to be queer to come here, but we take a lot of pride in creating a safe space for people who don't have a lot of safe spaces, especially in a place like Texas.
And how important do you think physical wellness is in actually helping people feel emotionally secure? I'm not sure that phrased that very well, but do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I think a couple of things. One, I think there's a certain level of pride that people take in moving their bodies in ways that feel good.
Yeah.
And so I think that does correlate to mental health. Like just being like, I'm moving my body, this feels good. Look, I'm getting stronger. I can lift more. I'm doing this in community. Like, I think that has a lot to do with mental health. Mm-hmm. But also what we're hearing a lot now, especially like the bathroom bill just got passed here earlier this week.
I read that. Yeah.
And so like, it's also a little bit empowering for folks to be like, I am strong. I am physically strong. Like I don't have to like cower to people who may be trying to intimidate me or something like that. Mm-hmm. And while we are not promoting physical violence in any capacity, I think it's more of like an internal empowerment thing of like, yeah. I can be safe on my own. Mm-hmm. But I think it also helps us talk about holistic wellness. And so for us, holistic wellness is like, we have a self-defense class, we offer physical therapy and massage, we offer financial literacy and queer sex ed and a clothing swap and like all of these other things. And because they trust us already with their physical health, whatever that may look like for them, they're like, oh, I can also learn how to pay off my debt. And I can also learn about dating while trans. And I can also come here and like look at some post-op stuff for like my upcoming gender affirming surgery. And so we create this like ecosystem almost where physical health is a part of it, but it is certainly not the whole picture. And we try really hard to allow people to come in and be holistically well. And we know physical wellness is a part of that, but we want to be like, okay, not all of us have access to our families of origin. So we don't all get passed down the information of like sex ed or financial literacy are probably the two biggest examples of that. And so like, we have a person in our community who works at Planned Parenthood and they were like, please let me teach queer sex ed. And we were like, great. Same thing with our financial literacy class. And so it's almost like mutual aid. Like these people come in, they run the workshops for free and they just say, we want to give y'all access to this information that we should have all had access to already.
When you listen to your dad, as all people should do, listen to their dads.
Right.
And you had that first day, you would have thought, okay, my garage is open for business. Is this where you thought it would get to? When that first person walked through the door and said, hey, I hear you doing some sort of fitness work in your garage. Can I come along and do something? And the way you are now.
I had no idea. I really didn't. I have been the most lucky in being surrounded, not only in my family, but like in friends and people who have helped me in business and all of the things. They always dream bigger than I do. Consistently. And so I first started this and one of my best friends at the time was like, this is going to be epic. Let me help you create this. They were the one who dreamt up the Transmask workout and like did all of the things. And the Transmask workout was our big first big push into the queer community. And so I have just been really lucky in that people have seen this vision far better than I ever could. And so yeah, I mean, no, I had no idea. We grew out of the garage gym in probably 6 months, and then commercial real estate takes as long as commercial real estate does. But yeah, and now, you know, we're already looking at our next move. And again, like I have people in my corner who are like, this can be huge. What about this? What about that? You know, and all these things. And so I will say I get to be the face and I get to do all of the things and do cool podcasts like this, but this is very much not a solo operation, and endlessly thankful to the folks who were involved at the beginning, who have been involved in any capacity, because they have been absolutely instrumental in what it is and what it will be.
I must admit, I had expected a very selfless answer, but I do hope you allow yourself a little bit of pride about what you've achieved.
No.
It's amazing. It really is, and it's not something we have anything like in the UK. And it's and I know, in particular, and I was looking at some of the legislation in Texas, and I was reading some things that have been put forward that even earlier this year there was a bill, thankfully, that didn't get through, that's put forward that it would be a felony if somebody identifies themselves as anything other than their sex that they were given at birth, and you think, my goodness, it's yeah, but trying to make it illegal to be who you are, with possible jail time. It does just feel extraordinary. But just back to the fitness side of it, and it's something I hadn't necessarily thought about before. So apologies, but I guess if you are going through hormone treatment or reassignment surgery or aftermath and all that sort of thing, then your fitness journey, regime, whatever, it's going to be different. You're getting used to a new body, how you feel mentally and physically. So I think, yeah, I can't imagine many gyms or fitness places build it into their programs, really. So actually having something go to, I think, gosh, I really enjoyed fitness before, but now I'm sort of changing and I feel this differently and I can't do this, or I can do this, and suddenly what do I do? And then, yeah, going somewhere where other people are doing that and actually being able to continue your wellness journey, I think it must be so important. So, yeah. So how do you work out the programs and the things that people need? Because you want to get things right, obviously, as a PT. Yeah? And I guess that's not something you necessarily spend a huge amount of time focusing on in PT school. So how do you get to that stage?
I will say a lot of trial and error. Lots of early clients gave me a lot of grace in figuring it out as we go. And you know, like, there are just things that are true, right? Like, we know for folks who are on T, they're going to want to work out a ton. They're going to have a lot of energy. They're going to build muscle really, really quickly. And we know that that can be associated with things like tendonitis, or like making the tendons a little bit more susceptible to injury. And so we know that from a PT standpoint, we can do things specifically for tendon loading that can help prevent some of that. Flip side of that, if people are on any kind of estrogen progesterone combo, we know that their tolerance to cardiovascular exercise goes down pretty significantly. And so we know, especially as they're starting that, we need to take longer rest breaks. Like, I start out doubling rest time when they first start their hormone therapy, and then we kind of work our way up from there. And so that's a pretty basic starting point. And then from there, really, we just listen to their bodies. Like, they come in next time and they're like, I was crazy sore, that was way too much. I'm like, okay, noted, got it, we can work with that. And then we just kind of go from there. And our transmasc and transfem workouts, they're a little bit more, so they're group classes, right? So they're not personalized specifically, but our transmasc workouts are definitely more geared towards like chest, upper back, and abs. Our transfems are more abs and hips, lower body, things like that. But we do also have a lot of pride in creating people who can like go into a gym and work out. So our trans masks still do leg day every once in a while, and they might not be super happy with me about it, but they know how to back squat because of it, right? Or deadlift. And so, we also want to make sure that we're like balancing a little bit, but I will say most of it is just having a baseline understanding of how hormones can affect exercise and bodies. And then really just like listening to our clients and letting them give us the information. We talk a lot about, like, I think it's really common in healthcare to be like, we are the expert, you need to listen to us. And we actually take the opposite approach. And I'm like, y'all are the expert on your bodies. I'm the expert on movement. So if we combine our two expertises, we're probably going to be in a really good place. But I'm never going to tell somebody I would never say, if they say to me, like, this doesn't feel good for my body, I would never say, well, we're just going to do it anyway. Like, that's crazy to me. And so that's kind of how we navigate that somewhat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what's your journey been like? So from being a sort of elite tennis player to where you are now, how's your own journey been with fitness and sport and wellness?
It's been very tumultuous. For as long as I can remember through college, I had coaches telling me when and where to be. I had workouts programmed me for 4 to 5 times a week. Like I never even had to consider it. I barely knew what I was lifting. Like it was all done for me. And it also food, like that was all done for me as well. And so I just didn't have to think about it ever. And so I went straight from college to grad school. And that was a really big shift for me, not only in terms of how hard grad school was compared to how hard college was, but also just because I had to then motivate myself to work out all the time. And so I gained a lot of weight at that point, which made it even less likely that I wanted to work out. And I had a best friend in grad school who I also played tennis with. So we knew each other from like a while back. And she kind of took me under her wing and was like, let me show you about exercise. Let me show you about movement. And so that was my really entry point into moving on my own. And like over the course of time, like I've enjoyed it more, I've enjoyed it less. That was like kind of how I figured out that I wanted to be in a bigger body. Like that's what feels good for me. I really like lifting heavy and being a little bit bigger is good for that. But you know, there are ebbs and flows. I don't play tennis anymore. I have barely touched a racket since I graduated in 2017. And so that was also a weird shift for me because I got a lot of exercise just from like playing sports, but I found joy in like, I joined like a queer dodgeball team and a queer kickball team and a pickleball, you know? So I'm like doing different things like that, that also I just enjoy. And so it's been a little bit of an up and down. But you know, I think right now, at least I feel like I'm in a good place with like how I think about movement, how I talk about movement with myself. I'm really good at talking about it to other people, but sometimes yes. Myself is a little bit tougher. And so I think right now I'm in a pretty good spot, but it definitely ebbs and flows and will continue to ebb and flow throughout my lifetime. Mm. Yeah.
It must be kind of funny when you've been to all intents and purposes, as a sort of professional athlete, and then you're sort of learning again about fitness and wellness and things. And one thing I often wonder, when people are as serious, good, and dedicated as you were to tennis, does that, it obviously must have an impact on the rest of your life because the time commitment and everything else. So, I don't know, social life, typical adolescence, you know, getting with guys or girls or whatever your flavor is and stuff. Is there almost an implicit understanding from the coach and things that that's all going to be put to one side? It's all about a sport and that, yeah, crushes and sex and love and intimacy, whatever. Yeah, you know, just forget about that. It's all about the sport. And then you're almost trying to catch it when you're, like, say, when you're at college or grad school or even later. And it's, yeah, I guess to some extent, people can be, and I mean this in the gentlest possible way, they can be fairly emotionally immature, I guess, when they get through that stage. Does that make sense?
I mean, I still to this day talk about huge gaps in like my personhood. Like I'm not very handy, but like there are just a bunch of examples where I'm like going about my day and like I'll be like, oh, like I don't know how to do this. I didn't know how to unlock a lock. That was an example. Our dumpster has a lock on it. And I put in the combo and I was like, I don't know, like fiddling with it. And I just couldn't get it. And then somebody was like, you have to push and then pull. Like, how do you not know that? And there are just a bunch of examples like that. And that's a silly one, but you know, like my life was tennis and it got a little bit better in college, although I played a lot of tennis. But like in high school, just to be able to like get recruited to play in college, it is a full-time job and then some. Like it's really, really intense. And in college, you know, I think I had all of the energy in the entire world. Like I would like go out and be with my friends and then play 4 hours of tennis and then work out and go to class and whatever. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I can't even imagine now, honestly, but it really is a full-time job. And the other thing that I think, like I think about a lot now is how much emphasis was placed on my body. Like college coaches would say to me when I was getting recruited, they would be like, you're really good at tennis, but we can't offer you a scholarship because of your body size. And like, so people were very, very constantly talking about my body. And it might, that may have been only me just because of my body size. Like, I don't know if other people like felt similarly, but certainly like, I remember like my sophomore year of high school through college, like my body was a very, very talked about subject. And that also had lasting impacts because like now in my life, I'm like, people don't care about my body. Like, they just don't care. And that was a super weird lesson for me to learn because for so long, all people talked about was my body. It felt like to me. And so that was also a really weird transition of like, oh, like maybe I lost a couple pounds. Maybe I gained a lot of pounds. Nobody actually cares. And I also don't care. So like, it's great all around.
It's funny if people have maybe seen the film, Moneyball, about baseball. And a lot of that was about that, people were overpaid or underpaid or under-recruited, depending on whether they looked like a ball player. So he pitches funny, he runs funny, he does this, but yeah, well, in the film it was always, does he get on base? But for you, it's like, well, but have I beaten these other five girls? Well, yes, but we can't recruit you. No, but I've beaten them all consistently. And it's that whole thing about wanting, and it's, yeah, that we almost had this, well, you hope it's sort of unconscious, but unconscious bias against so many different things. You hope it's not a conscious bias, but yeah, we have an expectation in our mind of what a successful basketball, baseball, tennis player, football player looks like. And it's, yeah, it's very difficult, I think. In terms of the US now, and it's kind of ironic you're in Texas because it doesn't feel very welcoming. So I guess two things, really. One, do you think that things will even out again and things will feel a bit safer in the US in the coming years? And then secondly, and you were talking about hopefully moving to a bigger property, et cetera. Do you ever have any fears that you'll be discriminated against, not being said or anything, but by landlords, whatever, because of the kind of thing that you do? And like I say, if it's bathroom mat, whatever, if people say, well, legally, can we sort of lease this building to you because of what you do and heal it? Does that create it must create a fear.
Yeah, I mean, to your first point, you know, I think this administration has made it clear what their intentions are across the board. I think the mindset globally for our community is we need to survive this, and then hopefully it will get better on the other end. So I don't know that I have a lot of hope that things will get better within this administration, but you know, I mean, you know, if we talk about history, like we know that it will get better, right? Like,
yeah, we
survive and come out the other side stronger and in more community. And we have been discriminated against quite a bit. We are trying to start a nonprofit arm of our business and mm-hmm. have been ghosted by 5 brokers, 3 nonprofit lawyers, and a couple of other people. And there have been a lot of people that have been great. So this is not across the board. There have been people who have shown up and have been absolutely wonderful. But certainly, like nonprofit lawyers kind of not giving us the time of day, telling us that our project isn't charitable, which is impossible. And brokers just literally hearing about our idea to the point where we don't actually tell them that it's a queer specific business that we're trying to run. But the other thing too, is that we might be moving away from the nonprofit idea because we have been advised to not use any DEI language in our mission and vision statement that we sent to the IRS.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to create a mission and vision statement that is that proves that it's charitable without using some of that language. And so we've been navigating some really interesting times just in that. And what the nonprofit lawyers were saying is we might not even get a rejection letter. We might just never get a response. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we're trying to navigate like the cost of a nonprofit lawyer and, you know, that whole thing with, depending on how we talk about it, maybe just never getting approval. And what do we do with that? And so, but yeah, I mean, certainly that's a concern. We also, you know, the way that we're branded right now, our marketing is definitely queer and trans. And that's definitely a lot of who we target, but like outwardly, we're not actually very queer. Like Out Wellness as a name can mean almost anything. And now once you know that it's queer, you're kind of like, oh, I get it, out, whatever. Right. But it's not outwardly queer, and neither are our colors, like neither is most of our branding. And so it's definitely a concern. We have doors that are locked all the time. You can only get in if you have an appointment or if you have a code. And so we take a lot of security measures there for sure. And there are things that we are looking for in our next space. Like we want a standalone space with our own parking lot and our own, you know, whatever. And that way we can put as much security as we want in there. Even in the next space, it will be similar where the branding won't be outwardly queer, but we'll probably have hints of queerness, almost like if you know, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there's a lot of that here. You know, we live in Austin, which is a safe haven place, in my opinion. I had my home address very, very visible for 3 years as the address of the business, and we never had any issues, knock on wood. But, you know, tensions are rising, period, here, like nationally. And we just have to be really careful about that. And, you know, like I said earlier, we take a lot of pride in creating a safe space for these communities, but we have to be really intentional about creating a physically safe space. Like, we're not just talking about gender-neutral bathrooms and trauma-informed language and things like that. We're talking about an actually physically safe space that people can come to. And so, we think about that constantly.
It's upsetting because it's something that most businesses don't need to think about. Gold's Gym don't think about that at all. It's right, where do we go? Okay, what's the, how do you market it? That's it. Whereas, and I liked the beginning when you were very clear that your big, I mean, I can't have it in the mission statement, I guess, is around inclusivity. So a lot of that, I've been having a lot of discussions lately about people trying to support people going through menopause, and people that obviously the fitness requirements and health requirements and the confusion around hormone replacement therapy, all those different things. And there's a massive drop off of people that go to the gym once they start going through those things because they feel different. They don't want to be there. They feel uncomfortable in their own bodies and things, but it just feels that your space is almost perfect for that. It's just, we're very welcoming. And as you say, we're not going to tell you what to do. We can offer you all of the kinesiology and the physical guidance and the pathways and things, but your body is what's going to inform you, and we're just there to support it. And that just feels like, it feels like, why on earth wouldn't that be a place that everybody would love?
And we do get lots of non-queer folks that come here. You know, it's certainly not that, but like, we're very clear. So we do a consult call with everybody before they can get on our schedules. And I'm very intentional about naming the primary population that we serve.
Yeah.
Because I want people to self-select out. I really do. Like, if they don't want to be here, I'm like, great. There are a lot of other places that you could go. You don't need to be here. This is for the people who want and need to be here. I do wish that kind of thinking was more commonplace, because it then empowers people to be like, I can go to Gold's and do a workout because my body will tell me exactly what I need to be doing, which is true. And so I wish there was more empowerment, especially in the perimenopausal population, because a lot of times they're like, I'm fragile and, you know, I need all the support and I don't know what I'm doing. And I'm like, you are not fragile. Like, your body has done incredible things. Like, you are not fragile. And so, yeah, I try really hard to flip that script for folks.
It does still very much feel that, trans is the word of the day in terms of how government, society, whatever is negating. There was, so very sadly, it was a shooting in Minneapolis yesterday, and one of the headlines, and it's a UK paper, the headline was, trans killer runs amok in Minneapolis. And I don't even know where to begin. And then afterwards, it was sort of saying, oh, this person wrote his manifesto where they regretted their transition. Oh, isn't that terrible? And it was all, and then it was a link to, well, and X percentage of people regret, and blah, blah, isn't it? And it was almost that the fact they were trans had something to do with the fact they were killing people. Yep. And it wouldn't have been, white man runs amok or kills, or cis man runs amok or kills, or straight woman runs amok. It just felt almost a similar way to the debate about trans athletes in sport, whatever, just always been a very, very negative thing. And I know it's an incredibly complicated topic. I have no suggestion that I have any knowledge of it whatsoever, apart from what I've read and hopefully try to learn a little bit. But there seems to be very, very little out there that communicates the positives of someone making probably the biggest change they can to, I would almost say, to start their life, if that makes sense. And I don't know how we help to generate stories that are much more positive. I mean, yours is a very positive story, the whole thing you've done, the person you are and what you've achieved, etc., and the wellness and the gym and everything is amazing. But how do we get the media to recognize the positive side of things? That's a big question, sorry. I don't know if you've got an answer, but it just feels sad.
It really is sad, because the statistics are crazy. Like, more people regret getting like a hip replacement than they do gender affirming surgery or hormone therapy. And so the statistics are by and large very positive. And we also know that because suicide rates in gender nonconforming and trans folks are so high, we actually talk about gender affirming surgeries and gender affirming care as life saving, because it cuts the suicidality almost in half. And so that's the way we talk about it, like within our community. But to your point from earlier, like, transphobia is rooted in misogyny and racism, right? To your point, you would never hear white man killer, go, blah, 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 right? You don't hear about that. You hear about his sob story, and you hear about how he was maybe abused in his childhood, or you hear all these things, and it's a very different rhetoric than when a trans person happens to do something wrong. And we live in a society where trans folks can't do anything wrong because there's rhetoric like this. Granted, I am not condoning what that person did. But it's just the language around it. Like, even here in Austin, we've had multiple instances, but the most recent one is, we have like a local spring, like a body of water, and a trans woman was really brutally attacked and killed. She was really attacked, not killed, because she like spurned a guy's advances. And when the local Austin media was talking about her, they were using a picture of her, a picture of like another guy to talk about her. Like, it was something crazy. And so then the anti-trans people were like, that's a trans woman. And we were like, actually, that's not a trans woman. That's not who we're talking about. It's actually somebody completely different. And so the media, I think it's their responsibility to report fairly and accurately. And I feel, and they rarely do that in the trans community. They're often reporting with wrong names, wrong pronouns, and they are aggressively targeting trans people who already make up well less than 1% of our population, right? So if like we're talking about marginalized people, we're talking about a very, very, very low number. And we're talking about a low percentage of that low percentage of folks who are committing awful crimes like what just happened in Minneapolis. So, we're talking about a very low number, but I think it comes from misinformation and fear mongering, right? Like, you have folks like J.K. Rowling and Martina Navratilova, for example, who have huge platforms, who are talking about men who want to take away jobs from women, or, whatever they're saying. Yeah. And when you really like talk to trans women, which I don't think either of them ever have, being a trans woman of color, but being a trans woman, period, is the most dangerous thing that you can be in the United States right now, period, full stop. It is aggressively dangerous. We have folks who are literally like wearing diapers or like peeing themselves because they are so afraid to go to a public restroom because of the backlash that they're going to get, that they are literally choosing to soil themselves instead. They are afraid to leave their houses. They're like, it is absolutely so dangerous. And so if you're trying to tell me that a quote unquote man wants to take away jobs from women so badly that they're willing to go through this, like, it's just very clear that they haven't met a trans person, especially a trans woman. And it's just really upsetting, right? Because I think society lacks a lot of empathy for the trans community. And a lot of times what we hear are things like, oh, I didn't know you were trans. Like, that like humanizes it for me. And I get it a little bit more now. And I'm like, that's fine. I'm happy to be that person for you. That's like not the answer, right? Like the answer is like, I don't know. Let me just believe them in their experience. And we talked a lot about this with like the Black Lives Matter movement, right? Where I'm like, I'm a white person. I can't begin to comprehend, but I'm going to show up and I'm going to protest with them and I'm going to believe them when they tell me that there's a lot of police brutality going on, because why would they lie about that? That's crazy. Yeah. And so it's really similar to a lot of like what was going on in like the George Floyd kind of era. Yeah. But I think it's a lot of fear mongering and a lot of people with platforms who are uninformed, and instead of trying to get informed, are just spewing hate.
Yeah, I think it upset me with J.K. Rowling and Martina. And I thought, what an amazing thing she did, come from sort of Eastern Europe and dominate and be this again, a tennis player didn't look like Chris Evert at the time, etc. And her argument is, well, you can get the 500th best male tennis player in the world can just say one day, right, I'm a woman now, and start playing the women's tournaments. Then, well, when would that ever happen? It just seemed to be almost an argument forced out of something. And the same with J.K. Rowling. It's sort of, well, you know, a man can just say, well, I'm a woman now, and go to a woman's bathroom. I said, but what are you talking about? There are laws and regulations against lots of these things. It just seemed to be picking on things that didn't need to be a thing, really, and making people uncomfortable when they're already possibly the most uncomfortable they could ever be.
And if we're really talking about protecting women and kids, I can think of a lot of spaces that are inherently more dangerous for them than going to the bathroom with a trans woman. Like, if we're really going to talk about that, we can talk about that. But don't use trans women as a guise for being like, we need to protect women and kids, because that's not what's going on here. Because if that's what was going on, we would include trans women in that statement, and then they would be inherently safer. I think especially in the case of Martina Navratilova, she has this platform because, like you said, and for a long time, I really liked Martina Navratilova. Like, she was one of the first out queer people in tennis. She did a lot of really good things for the sport in that regard. Like you said, she looked a little bit different. She absolutely dominated. So she has this platform, and the tennis community does use her as their quote unquote token queer person. But she spews all of this hate. And what are you talking about? Like, what man on the men's tour has come out and said that they want to play on the women's tour because they're a woman? Like they're talking in all of these, you know, like grand things that may or may not happen. And to your point, they're just not happening. No. Just not happening. We had more than one, but Leah Thomas was like the big one, and she won the NCAA swimming. I can't remember which.
Yeah, she's the one we always get seen over here. Yeah.
Yeah. And it started this huge thing. And I'm like, and they're talking about like biological advantage and all these things. And I'm like, Martina, you are one of the best athletes of all time. You don't think you have a biological advantage? You don't think Michael Phelps has a biological advantage? Like, what are you talking? Of course she has a biological advantage. She's a really good athlete. Like, that's part of how you get to be at that level, is because you have a little bit of a biological advantage. And whether you're cis or trans, that's true. And so, like, I think, you know, it's fear-mongering without critical thinking. And because if like, you really think about it, like, Michael Phelps is a great example. They talked a lot about like his wingspan was way longer than his height, and he had webbed toes, and he had like all these things. And he was one of the best athletes of all time. He's one of the most decorated Olympians of all time.
Yeah.
But like when we talk about him, we're like, oh my God, he's so impressive. And then when we talk about Leah Thomas, who, by the way, is at a way lesser level, she wasn't competing in the Olympics, and people throw a fit. And it's just like, it doesn't make any sense. And if anything, it's hurting cis women, because instead of, you know, in sports, when you lose, you go back and you're like, I got to practice harder. I got to do better. This person beat me. She's not going to beat me next time. And instead of allowing cis women the opportunity to do that,
yeah,
they're just like, well, we'll just sue her. We'll just get her title taken.
Yeah. We'll get an asterisk against it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so it hurts everybody, but of course it hurts trans women the most. And, you know, if we're talking about trans women in sport, like, can you name 5 trans women that are actively in sports right now? Like, it's such a wild goose chase. Like, it's a crazy thing that we even have to spend time talking about it, you know?
Mm. I've taken a lot of your time. You've been very generous, but I do want to ask 2 more questions. That's okay.
Sure.
One of which, I'm no idea if you haven't answered this, but it does strike me still as very, very odd that there seems to be a lot more women that are comfortable coming out as gay or whatever within sports. So within soccer, particularly, say within tennis, is a great example. When you compare that to men, it's still, there's still very, very few professional athletes. Again, that people, could you name 10 professional male athletes that come out as gay? I don't know, but within sport, within soccer, most England women's football team is, there's lots of sort of female tennis players, there are lots of athletes. Why do you think men are still so hesitant or reluctant? Is it commercial? Is it that Nike aren't going to sponsor you if you're, you know, a well-known gay basketball player? Is this still relevant?
You know, I think there's a lot of stigma, and the stigma is around masculinity. Mm-hmm. And I think being a gay man, like, you know, I think societally, especially in the world of sports, like, you lose a little bit of that masculinity. Like, we're even seeing right now a lot of NFL teams, which is the, like, American Football League here, they ended their contract with Stonewall, which is a, it's nothing, but like captains wear rainbow, armband or something like that. And they just were like, that doesn't align with our values. And then there actually was a guy, a football player who came out and then like almost immediately got cut because one of his teammates was like, he touched my butt or something. Like, crazy. Oh, truly.
We're 70s old again, isn't it?
It's
not like, funny at all. But
truly. Yeah. And like, it's funny because it's true. Like, that's what happened. And so I think, I mean, in my opinion, it's a lot of toxic masculinity. It's this idea that like my manhood is not only tied to my masculinity, but tied to how other men interact with me. Yeah. And inherently the belief is that if you're a gay man, you're not masculine and you're going to hit on every man you see. Like, there's no ability to regulate when you're at your job or playing a sport or whatever. And so I was really actually thrilled when that guy came out. Like, I was like, this is great. Like, he's a really good football player. Like, surely everything is going to be fine. And yeah, of course it didn't. But, you know, and of course, like, locker rooms were getting undressed around each other a lot and things like that. But for cis women, like, we just do that anyway. Like, I grew up at sleepovers getting changed in front of my friends and not showering with them, but like, you know, there's like a glass door and one person's in the shower, one person's getting ready. Like, there's a lot of overlap and looking at each other's bodies in a non-sexualized way. But I think cis men have a hard time with like, how can you be naked and not be sexual? Or how can, like, they sexualize a lot. And so they have trouble understanding that people can actually separate that. And be like, I'm attracted to men, but I'm not attracted to you. And that
might be hard. I can almost hear it. It's just like, what? That doesn't mean that could be right. You, almost, honestly, I think there's a cis man thing where if somebody in the locker room happens to be gay, well, but look at an erection just looking at me.
Right.
Not, does every woman in the world fancy you? Probably not. So why would every man in the world fancy
you? I think that's part of the problem.
I honestly think that, I don't know, he's gay, I can't go in a shower with him. But what do you think's going to happen? You really think that you're going to bend over and grab the soap? And it really, this is
not
a prison comedy. Life is not a prison comedy.
Right. And by the way, this goes back to cis men being the way more dangerous than trans women, right? Like, you have cis straight men that are literally so scared of cis gay men that they are getting them kicked off of teams. They're not sharing with them. They're not doing all these things.
Yeah.
Why is it if you're not scared of them, right? Like, if there's not a little bit of like a, well, what's going to happen if I go into the shower with them right now? And so, like, it all ties back into, you know, misogyny, racism, and transphobia being very closely linked. But I think broadly, like, it's toxic masculinity and fear mongering and lack of understanding of what being gay actually means.
My last question, and I hope you do this, but obviously a lot of things you do are incredibly rewarding, but also conversely incredibly challenging. So how do you nourish and protect your own mental well-being? Because you don't want to take it on board, but you've got to leave it somewhere to carry the pain that a lot of people must feel around with you. It's not something you want at all.
Yeah, actually, a lot of people have been asking me this recently. I feel super lucky. I get a ton of nourishment out of the community that we've created here. And so we do a lot of, like, I call them group activities. Like, we're going swimming this weekend. We do crafts nights. We do like movie nights, and we do a lot of stuff like that. And so leaning back into this community, like, they've become my great friends. They've become my chosen family. And so being able to just like pour back into these people who then pour into me, is so beautiful, and that I get a lot of nourishment out of that. And I mean, chosen family generally, I've definitely have chosen family outside of this community too, but, it's really beautiful when we can create community that like tells each other when we need help and like tells each other when we're struggling and like we show up for each other. So it's not just this like superficial, like, we work out together and then we leave. It's much, much deeper than that. And so, like, I showed up like a month ago to the trans mask workout, and I just like cried. Like, I was like, I am having the worst week. I kind of can't lead this workout. And first of all, the community showed up and like totally was like, you just stay here and like, we'll lead this workout kind of thing. And I probably had 15 text messages by the time I walked out of the gym that day of like people checking on me, asking if they can bring me food, like things like that. And that is what gives me so much joy and kind of like fills my soul. Even with all of the hard work, even with all of like being at the Capitol and doing all the things, like, that is what drives me.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for your question with answers and just sharing a lot that I didn't already know. So I really hope one day that if it's the right thing, it's a national, international show. I'd love to see one of your At Wellness in London. The first London one should be amazing.
I'll come say hi when that happens. How about that?
Oh, fabulous. Yeah. I expect to be invited to the opening day. All right. Well, just keep doing what you're doing. That's all I can say. And keep being you. But thank you so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate your time.